Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Adria Breyer, a member of the Health and Medicine Committee, and your forum for today. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. We will also have an audio recording of Bruce's speech today because we were so overbooked we had no room for everyone. We apologize, and we're hoping to get him in the future again. Hint, Bruce. All right. A little bit about Bruce. I'm going to quote from Greg Braden, who I'm sure this audience has heard of. In a style that is as accessible as it is meaningful, Dr. Bruce Lipton offers nothing less than the long-sought-after missing link between life and consciousness. I have no doubt that his book, The Biology of Belief, will become a cornerstone for the science of the new millennium. Now, let me tell you a little bit about why Bruce is exceptional. Most of us who are here think a little bit outside the paradigm of the traditional medical model. But we need people like Bruce to bring that outside paradigm to us. Let me give you some of his background. He's a PhD cell biologist and lecturer, internationally recognized leader in the new biology. His pioneering research on cloned stem cells presaged the revolutionary field of epigenetics, which is the new science of how environment and perception control genes. Now remember that most of us are programmed to believe that every time somebody has an illness, we're told it's related to our genes. We now have a man who stepped outside of the paradigm, walked away from an incredibly prestigious job because his integrity would not allow him to continue to teach students and the public that what they were being taught was in fact the truth. We have so much to be grateful for here. And in that context that he walked away from, he served on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and then went on to perform groundbreaking research at Stanford University's School of Medicine. He's the best-selling author of The Biology of Belief and Spontaneous Evolution. In 2009, he received the prestigious 2009 GOE Peace Award. That award is from an organization dedicated to promoting world peace, transcending all boundaries of race, religion, politics, with a belief that peace begins in the mind of each individual. And I'm going to read you one more thing because it is so germane to all of us. We don't know everything about how epigenetics works during pregnancy, but we do know that the foods you eat, the chemicals you ingest or inhale, push a lot of circuit breakers on and off in your body. We know that this isn't limited to a developing fetus and it continues throughout your life. And that is basically what Bruce is going to tell us, that we can control a great deal of our own lives by taking charge and not being programmed the way we were believed things had to be. Dr. Bruce Lipton, I am so grateful for you to be here.
Thank you all very much. I'm very honored that you're all here and taking your time to listen to this, and I hope I can excite you with some wonderful information about the times we are facing right now. That we are now facing, actually, the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. Five previous times on this planet, life essentially got wiped out and started all over again. And what's different about the previous five and the current one is that the previous five have been attributed to things like asteroids or comets hitting the Earth or geological upheavals that just wiped out the biosphere. What's different about the mass extinction we're facing right now, and it's so critical that the concept of an ocean without fish is a realistic perception for within 30 years from now. I mean, just that concept is almost like science fiction to me just to hear something like that. That they say within 50 years at the rate we're going right now, we're going to need two planet Earths to supply the materials to keep us alive. Obviously, we're in trouble. And the issue about this trouble is that we're really converging on the end of civilization as we know it, which is good news and bad news. The bad news, of course, is it really changes everyone's life on here. And the good news is if we don't change, there won't be any more life left on here. So basically, we are facing a time of choice. And it's an interesting thing because the evolution we're facing is a participatory evolution, meaning it's not a passive thing. You sit in your house and one day you wake up and then evolution has occurred. And the reason why this is so important is that humans evolved 400,000 or more years ago. What's evolving is not the human being. We already did that. What's evolving is the community of human beings called humanity. And each of us is the equivalent of the cell in the body of humanity. And if I asked how humanity was doing today, I'd have to tell you, well, quite unfortunately, we're almost have a terminal case of autoimmune disease. And autoimmune disease means that your cells are fighting each other. And this is what the world is now having to realize, that we're all part of one superorganism. The evolution that's interesting is not a physical evolution, but it's a functional evolution. And it has to deal with changing of consciousness. We have to really start to get back who we really are, because for the last couple of thousand years, we have all been disempowered. And we find ourselves perceiving that we're weak and frail and vulnerable human beings when this is farthest thing from the truth possible. And so what I would like to talk to you about is a new biology. And what's fun for me is this new biology for me started back in about 1967. And when I first started talking about this biology, which was about 1980 in the public, it was interesting because at that time I was met by my colleagues and they said, "You are so crazy." And that wasn't like a congratulations, hey, crazy man, but crazy. And what was interesting about that is that was the reception I got back then. And now it's funny because a reception I can get from leading scientists today is, and I have gotten this, is, what are you saying that's new? And so there's been a great transition over these years. And what I'd like to talk about is the nature of this new biology. The first thing I wanted to say is this, is that there's a misperception when you look at yourself, because when you see yourself as a single entity, this is where we go wrong. And the reason why is this: you look in the mirror, you see a single individual looking back, you say, that's me. And I say, well, what's me? And what's me is simply this. We are a community of 50 trillion cells. That's what a body is. The living elements are the cells. And you say, well, then what's me? And what I would suggest when you say what's me is that you have to recognize you are speaking for a community of 50 trillion citizens. And so you're not a one thing. You are a whole civilization underneath your skin right now. And what's also very interesting about this is if you really understand the nature of cell biology, there's an interesting fact that almost all of your cells have every function that you have in your body. So if I had a textbook of, let's say, human physiology, and I listed all the systems, digestive, respiratory, excretory, nervous system, musculoskeletal, cardiovascular, even immune system, I have to tell you that virtually every cell in your body has every one of those functions. Every cell has organelles where we have organs, so they're parallels. You can understand a human and a cell because they're images of each other. And what's really most important about all this is that these cells are not disconnected from us. These cells, if you understand what they really are, cells are miniature people. They live in a community. When the politics of the community is good, you get health in the community. When the politics of the community is not working that well, you can cause complete disruption of the society. It's the same whether you're talking about a community of cells or a community of people, because we're all sharing the same biological entities. We're all living organisms that are modeled, in fact, after the cell. Well, it's very interesting because what I was teaching for years and what they're still teaching in conventional textbooks, and this is where the misleading part comes, is because conventional textbooks are teaching beliefs that are very outdated. And yet, there hasn't been a tendency to really correct them yet. I guess it takes 10 or 15 years before the new ideas actually start to penetrate into the system. But the problem is this. The ideas that we have been taught are so disempowering of human individuality that it is really the cause of most of the upheaval on this problem, or most of the evil on this world, excuse me. So I want to talk about miniature people. And then I said, well, where do we get our characteristics from? And this is what I was teaching. At that time, let's say go back to the 70s, when I was teaching in medical school, we were teaching the concept that our traits are controlled by genes. And the significance about that is then we look and say, well, then my life is, since it's controlled by these genes, and apparently I don't control my genes, that was a belief system. Then we all of a sudden saw ourselves as more or less determined, our lives are controlled by these genes, and we become kind of irresponsible when you start to recognize, well, if my genes control this and I don't control my genes, what can I do about it? And that's when people sort of let go of, well, I can't do anything about it, just let's go with this life that we have. Well, the concept of DNA came to us in 1953 with the work of Watson and Crick, and it became very public. And that was the point where, oh, my goodness, I remember the first day this really came out in the media, because I was a much younger person at that point, 1953. And I remember the morning paper came, and it was a New York tabloid, which always had some big photograph on the front and some headlines. And yet today, that day, I opened it up. The entire front page was filled with big, bold, black font that said, "Secret of Life Discovered." And this is what came out of the DNA work. Oh, my God, our traits are controlled by the DNA, and the DNA represents the blueprints of the parts that make up our body. So since the DNA controls the development of the parts, then DNA controls our lives. Well, this is what we bought into in a concept about how genes control our lives. It was interesting because within 5 years after the DNA discovery by Watson and Crick, Francis Crick came up with a hypothesis, and the hypothesis is called the central dogma. And the significance about this, and this is the actual name in the literature, it's called the central dogma, was a belief that was based on people's assumptions at the time. So the assumptions already preceded the science. And the science, the assumptions were that life is built out of material things, chemistry and physical things, and that a body is like a robotic device, and that at the core of it will be something physical that controls the body like a computer. And at this point, when DNA came in, everybody said, oh my God, this is just fitting the bill. Well, this is where the hypothesis of the central dogma was created by Francis Crick. And what he says is, in biological systems, information flows in one direction. It starts with DNA, then is converted into RNA, which is like a Xerox copy of the DNA. And the RNA is a blueprint that is used to make the body's proteins. And you say, well, what does all this mean? I say, well, the DNA is the master blueprint to make the proteins. And then I say, but the proteins are what give you your physical structure. And the proteins give you your behavioral traits. So in a realistic sense, a human body is almost like a protein mechanism. It's the primary elements that give us our physical reality. And since the proteins are programmed by the DNA, then that immediately led to that we are then controlled by the genes, because those are the blueprints that determine our traits. The important understanding about the central dogma in that unilateral flow of information from DNA to RNA to protein is that what it says is that information doesn't go backwards. And you say, well, yeah, but what does that mean to me? And I go, well, you're the protein at the bottom of the flow chart. Your life is protein. And I say, well, when you're living your life or you're in your body and you're in your protein, can you in any way send information back and alter your genetics? And the answer is absolutely not. The flow is only from the DNA down into the protein. Well, that is the commitment then to a great problem for our lives, because as illustrated, we believe that genes control life, and we just bought into that. Everybody expected to find something that did it, that was going to be material. And when it came up and Francis Crick presented this hypothesis, everybody said, oh my God, this is exactly what we were looking for. The answers are clear. We know how biology works now. And everyone got excited. We started to see many articles at that time started coming out about how our lives are the printout of these genes, and that our traits are controlled by these genes. And the concept that we were teaching was called genetic determinism. And the belief is genes determine your traits. So at the moment of conception, your life is somewhat blueprinted already, and then you just have to then activate the genes and then live out the life. And if there's cancer or Alzheimer's or diabetes built into that lineage, well, that's an unfortunate situation, because we stop and we say, well, according to our awareness is, well, A, we didn't pick the genes as far as we know. We can't change the genes if we don't like the traits that we have. And the genes control us. And what that really leads us to believing about ourselves is that we are victims of our heredity, that it's running in our family, and now we just have to put up with this. And there's a big problem, and here's the very big problem, because we're paying for it big time today, is that if you find yourself as a victim, what do you need? And the answer is, you need a rescuer. And all of a sudden, we start to invest in the rescuer because our lives can't be handled by ourselves. So the next thing you turn around, we have the pharmaceutical company there at your doorstep telling us they're going to rescue us with all these chemicals and drugs that they're making. So we bought into that vision because we bought into the belief of victimizations about who we really are. Now, what's interesting is that what I'd like to show you in the next slide, for example, is that we have a belief. And that belief is that, and you read this in the textbooks, that if you look at the cell, those little miniature people that live in your body, and they have organelles in them, the biggest organelle, the biggest structure in the cell is something called the nucleus. And the nucleus is where the DNA is essentially all found. There's some in the mitochondria, but that's not relevant to this discussion. And so the point about it is this, is, well, since the DNA is believed to control life, and since the DNA is focused inside the nucleus, which is sort of the where all of these DNA is collected together, we gave the concept of the brain of the cell and gave that to the nucleus. And the reason why is, well, it contains the genes, and the genes make the decisions. So the nucleus is that brain of the cell. That was our belief system. And it's added, it says that in the textbooks. And this is actually just from the National Institute of Health, a simple booklet for the public to understand how cells work. And this is just a couple of years ago, and it says the nucleus is the brain of the cell. And then it also underlines that the nucleus determines the cell's characteristics and masterminds its activities. So basically, we give that structure, and I said, remember, every organelle, miniature organ in a cell, is the equivalent of an organ in the human body, so we have made the nucleus equivalent to the brain, organelle to organ, in that understanding. And yet then I go and say a very simple fact about brains, and that is, when you believe that the nucleus is the brain of the cell, then you have to understand this, that if you have an organism and you take the brain out of that organism and throw it away, there's an inevitable consequence of doing that, and that is the organism dies. Simple fact. And I go, well, cool, let's go look inside a cell. And I say, oh, inside the cell, we have this thing called the nucleus, which is the brain of the cell. And you can take the nucleus out. And I actually did this work 40 years ago in removing the nuclei from cells with a micropipette and pulling it out. And lo and behold, the cells didn't die at all. That cells live for two or more months without any genes in it. Now, they're not just sitting there. They're doing every function they were doing before. They were moving around. They're eating, digesting, breathing, communicating with other cells. They avoid toxins. So their life is essentially unchanged behaviorally, and they have no genes in it and no nucleus in it. So at some point, the concept that the nucleus is the brain of a cell, when you start to realize you can remove the nucleus and the genes and you haven't perturbed the behavior of that cell, then the concept that the nucleus is the brain of a cell, that fails. That fails big time. The nucleus is not the brain of the cell. And you might say, okay, what is the nucleus? And I say, well, the nucleus is where all the blueprints are to make all the parts. I say, ah, so you need the nucleus to reproduce the proteins or reproduce the cell. I go, absolutely. And I go, ah, that's where the problem comes from. The nucleus is not the brain of the cell. The nucleus is the gonad of the cell. It's the reproductive organ. And as I usually talk about it, science is a male-dominated profession, and apparently males thinking with that organ, then making the brain of the cell that same thing, it all fit at that moment. But the simple fact, and this is an absolute fact, this is a fact, genes do not control biology. And the emphasis is on the word control. Because when you buy the word control, that means actualization or activation, that a gene makes a decision. And yet you read articles all the time in the newspaper, a gene turned on and a gene turned off and a gene causes this and a gene causes that. And what I'm going to tell you right now, every one of those concepts is totally false. For a simple reason. Genes have no self-actualization. Genes are blueprints. It's exactly what they are. And you want to say, well, what is the role of the blueprint? You say, well, go talk to an architect. She's working on some blueprints. You lean over her shoulder and you say, excuse me, is your blueprint on or off? And of course she'd look at you like, what are you, crazy? There's no on and off to a blueprint. And I go, precisely. There is no on and off to a gene. And as a result, if you really understand this, then you start to recognize that that belief that we've been holding on to all the time, that genes make actual things happen because they make decisions, is a totally false statement. I mean, if blueprints were self-actualizing, an architect would just need to go by the building site, throw the blueprints in the lot, drive away, come back a few months later, and there's this big building. Well, we say, oh, yeah, the sperm and egg come together, the blueprints are there, and then, boom, all of a sudden this building called the body creates, and it's like, this is not the way it works. there's an important interaction with the environment. The environment actually has more power over the reading of the genes than the genes have power of reading themselves for a long shot. So let's get rid of the concept that genes are self-actualizing. So first thing is they control nothing. They don't control themselves. They don't control you. That's a given. And I say, well, what does work? How does it work? Well, this is the part that really blew my mind 44 years ago when I was cloning stem cells. Now, back 44 years ago, there were only a handful of people in the whole world that knew anything about stem cells, and I was very fortunate enough to get my degree at the University of Virginia under a famous cell biologist, Erwin Konigsberg, who created the cloning technique for cloning stem cells. And I worked with him, and it was really great. And I just want you all to know there's no shortage of stem cells for you in this audience because you're here. And what does that mean? I say, well, everyone has stem cells. So I'll tell you what they are. They're the equivalent of embryonic cells that are in your body after you're born. And they have to be there for a very important reason. And here's the reason. Every day we lose hundreds of billions of our cells due to attrition, old age, and damage. Blood cells are replaced continuously. Skin cells are replaced continuously. The entire lining of the digestive tract is replaced every 3 days. And the relevance is, well, you're replacing hundreds of billions of cells a day. Where the heck are you getting hundreds of billions of cells from? The answer is stem cells. So if you're alive and you're replacing these cells, which means that's what will keep you alive, by definition, you're already filled with stem cells. So let's just recognize we all have stem cells. What my research was really about was I would isolate one single stem cell and put it into a culture dish by itself. And what would happen is every 12 hours, the cell would double. So I'd have one cell, then 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 cells. After a couple of weeks, I have thousands of cells in the petri dish. But what was so critically important is this. All the cells are genetically identical because they came from the same parent cell. So this is called cloning. I have thousands of genetically identical cells. Now here's where the experiment goes. I go into that dish of stem cells and pull out a bunch of those cells and put them into another dish with a different culture medium. And I say, well, the chemistry is slightly different. You say, but what is the culture medium? I say, well, cells are like fish. That's why they live under your skin in fluid. The cells live in a fluid environment. So I create a fluid environment for the cells. That's called the culture medium. The medium is the environment. So in environment A, with a composition that is environment A, my stem cells form muscle. I go, that's really cool. And I go, let's go back to the same dish, take some more of the genetically identical cells out, put it into petri dish B with environment B, a different chemical composition. Those cells form bone. I go, well, that's even fun, but I got one more. I just go back to the main stem cell dish, pull more of the cells out, put it into a third petri dish with yet a different environment. And in dish C, the cells form fat cells. Now you're left with a very simple yet very profound question. What controls the fate of the cells? And the answer is, well, firstly, they were all genetically identical. So you can't say the genes were different and that's why the cells went this way or that way. The only thing that was different was the environment. So as you change the environment, you change the genetic fate of the cells. Well, at this time back in when I was doing all this research and everyone was so gung-ho that genes were turning on and off, of course, my research got by a lot of people put on the side as being an anomaly. It's just an exception, and we don't want to talk about it because we're all proceeding into that genetic gold mine that everybody was investing in genes. And my work got put on the sidelines, which was cool except for the simple reality. I repeated the experiments over and over again. My colleagues saw them over and over again, and they just didn't want to bring it in because it didn't fit their storyline. And at some point, I was teaching medical students the concept that people are victims. And I all of a sudden saw, no, why? Because I can change the fate of the cells by changing the environment. So all of a sudden, it says, well, then the genes were not controlling this. I couldn't continue teaching that. I left the system, got into some quantum physics, which really helped me, because my pursuit was, how does an environmental signal ultimately control the genes? And so I started looking at this area of research. And what really did is lead me out of the conventional world, and then later had the opportunity to come back into the system through Stanford, which has had big open mind compared to other universities that listen to my story. And it was good because I provoked them with the concept that genes may not be controlling life in a community that was so gene-centric, that this was an outdoor, outside belief system. But they let me come in, and it was great because The research I did at Stanford followed through exactly the same results, expanded the understanding to a much higher level, and gave great insight into the mechanisms of how those environmental signals are translated into your behavior, into your life, and into the fate, especially of your genes. So if I would say, how does it all work? Then I would try to give you the simplified version of how biology works. And it's basically simple because I start with the first assumption is this, is that you have to understand that your cells are made out of protein building blocks. That's where the structure comes from and the behavior comes from. The proteins are the primary elements. In fact, the word protein means primary element. And so you have about 150,000 different proteins that make up your body. And so that each cell is a whole composition of different organization and different amounts of these different proteins working together to create a cell. I go, well, that's really nice about the proteins that makes a physical cell. And I would say if you look at a cadaver, you'll find what? A protein machine. But the thing, it's missing life. And so what is it? It's not just the proteins that make life. There's a second character that has to be added to the proteins to then generate life. And that character is this. Here are three examples of proteins on the screen right here. And what I want to show you is this. Proteins are like a yarn that can be knitted into different structures. Now think about that. You can take a piece of yarn, same piece of yarn, and you can twist it and knot it in one way and make mittens out of it, or you can untie it and re-knot it and make something, you know, like a tea cozy, whatever that is, and you can make that out of it, or you can unknit it and you can make a sweater out of it, and what's the point? A string can be folded and knotted to create different three-dimensional structures. A protein, by its definition, is a linear string of amino acids. And what's interesting is the amino acids are a knitting code. They tell how the string, once it's synthesized, will fold up and make the final knitted structure. So a protein has a three-dimensional structure. Each one is different, and the structure is based on the sequence of the amino acids. You go, well, that's nice. I go, yeah, but here's the thing about the knitting structure. It's based on the distribution of electromagnetic charges throughout the length of the string. And I say, well, what if you change the electromagnetic field around the protein, change the salt, the pH, or whatever, and guess what happens? The protein will unravel in one form and rewrap into a second form. So it says, oh, an environmental signal can cause a protein to change from shape A to shape B. And I go, that is the secret of life. And the reason is this. A cadaver has the shape of a body of a human, but it doesn't move. Life doesn't happen. Why? Because life is movement. I say, yeah, but where does movement come from? I say, ah, the proteins in the body can change shape. And if you use that shape change to create work from that, so as this protein is moving, you attach it to do some work with that movement, then you start to realize where the processes of life come from, like respiration or digestion or excretion. They're the output of a protein machine moving and changing the shape of the parts. It's like gears engaging with each other, and as they move, they cause the gears to move, you create a function. So I basically say, well, yeah, every protein has a unique three-dimensional structure, and every protein responds to an environmental signal that will cause the structure to vacillate between A and B, which are called conformations or shapes. And as the protein moves, these movements are harnessed by the cell to carry out the metabolic and life functions of a living cell. And each protein not only has its own unique physical three-dimensional characteristic, but each protein has its own particular movement that responds to its own particular signal. So I have 150,000 different proteins, and they respond to different signals. So you can orchestrate the movement of the proteins, which is the behavior of the living system, by orchestrating the signals. And so when you control the signals, that's where you control life. I say, well, how does it work? Well, I go back and show a picture of a cell in a petri dish. This is an animated version of it. And I say, well, there's a cell in the petri dish. And I say, well, what happens? And I say, well, look, go back to my special petri dishes where I put the cells and I change the environment. I say, let's add chemicals to, you know, signals. I add some signals to the environment. The signals come down in the culture dish like rain. And some of the signals attach to the surface of the cell. And I go, well, yeah, but what happens when it attaches to the surface of the cell? And that's like, ah, the cell relays the information about the signal at the surface, and sends it inside the cell, and that signal is then used to cause proteins to move that generate a behavior. Different signals from the environment affect different proteins in the cell, creating different functions. So I can regulate digestion with one set of signals, regulate respiration with another set of signals, or movement with another set of signals. So basically, what I'm doing is showing is that the cell responds to the environmental signals by generating behavior, which is the result of proteins moving in response to the signal. The membrane sends a signal in. Now, here comes an interesting part. If I need a protein to do a behavior, but the protein's not at that time in the cell, I say, well, how do you make a protein? I say, oh, well, the nucleus has the blueprints. I say, oh, so then what do you have to do? Well, the environmental signal now is directed to the nucleus, where it engages the reading of a specific gene that will make the protein that you need to engage in the behavior. So the signal from the environment doesn't just activate the behavior of the cytoplasm of the cell. It actually goes into the nucleus and selects different genes based on the signal to create the proteins that are needed to respond to the signal. So this is how we send signals inside the cell. So, okay, what's at the surface that reads these signals? Because there's obviously something at the surface, and the cell responds to 1,000 or more different signals. What's at the surface that can respond individually to each different signal? And then I tell you, built into the cell membrane, there are switches that control the behavior and the genetics of the cell. The switches represent what controls the brain of the cell. And I say, so then the brain of the cell, by this definition, is the membrane of the cell, the skin of the cell. And it makes sense why the skin is the brain, because the skin is the interface between the outer world and the inner world. So the skin can see both environments simultaneously. And as a result, the skin can read what's going on the outside and modify what's going on in the inside and control biology from that point. More interesting than that is if you understand the nature of human embryology, I say if you go back in the embryo, I say, so where did the nervous system come from? And there are three germ layers that form in a very early embryo, and some people might remember these words from old high school day. The three germ layers from the outer to the inner are called ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm. Derm means layer. Ecto means outer. Each layer of the three gives rise to different organs and tissues. So I stop and I say, okay, so what does the ectoderm give rise to in a human being? And I say two things, skin and nervous system. So the human, like the cell, the skin is the source of the nervous system. And what's interesting then is, how do you behave? And remember, humans and cells are equivalents to each other. So I say, how do you respond to the world? And I say, well, I got receptors. I have eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, pain, pressure, temperature, all these different receptors. I say, where are these receptors built in your body? And the answer is, they're all built into your skin. I go, precisely. And what's the function of it? Well, as you walk through the world, the receptors read the environmental information through the skin, and then the skin, which becomes a nervous system, sends that information to the body to coordinate the functions. I say, exactly the same thing with a cell. It's the exact same thing. So if I show you what a switch looks like, it actually has two parts to it. The two parts are a receptor, which are like miniature eyes, ears, nose, or whatever, and they have antennas on them, and they respond to vibrational signatures. And there's something called an effector. That's the second part of the switch. The receptor receives the environmental signal. That's what receptor means. Effector is the second part of the switch that converts the signal into a signal that goes inside the cell and controls the biology. So the receptor reads the outer world signals, and the effector translates those signals by sending a signal inside the cell. And just to show you what it looks like in an animated form, what you can see is there's a connector piece that shows up to connect the receptor and the effector. That's a protein called the G protein, and it has a special shape to it. When the receptor protein is not stimulated, then it has conformation or shape A, and it won't allow the switch to connect. But when the signal shows up, changes the shape of the protein, it causes the connector to connect the receptor to the effector. And this is what now activates the switch, because now the effector sends its signal inside the cell and controls the function. When the environmental signal goes away, then the receptor protein returns back to its original shape, and the connector part disconnects, and the switch is broken. So it really works out how simply it works is the receptor is scanning the environment for a signal. When the signal shows up, the connector connects it to the effector protein. The effector protein sends a signal inside the cell, and that controls behavior. And this is exactly the same thing that happens in your system for a very simple nervous system. I would say you have a sensory and a motory nervous system. The sensory system picks up the signals, and the motor system sends the signals in. So in a cell membrane, there are two proteins that do that. Well, this is a switch. And it's an interesting switch. There's about 100,000 different switches on the surface of a cell responding to thousands of different signals of the environment of the cell. And I go, well, what's the name of the switch? And then I can say, okay, like a scientist, I can give you the Latin name. And the significance about that is science, like the church, writes its stuff in language that the lay people don't have any idea what the hell we're talking about. And so I'll give you the scientific name for this switch is a receptor effector integral membrane protein complex. And everybody goes, wow, that's really nice. Thanks. And I go, okay, how about if I make it personal? Let's put a name on it that people understand. So I say, I can do this by defining each part of the switch. So I say, what's the function of the receptor? What's the function of your eyes, ears, nose, and taste? I say, what do they do? And the answer is, they provide you with awareness of the environment. I say, okay, cool. What's the function of the second protein called the effector, the one that sends a signal in? Oh, that's a protein that converts the signal into a physical sensation that enters into the cell, and that physical signal inside the cell controls the functions. So I say, then the function of the switch, by definition, the function is an awareness of the environment through a physical sensation. I go, cool, that's the function of the switch. And I say, well, that's a very familiar term. And I say, where? I go in the dictionary, and there's the word perception. And there's the definition right there in the word perception. It says awareness of the elements of the environment through physical sensation. And then I then say very simply this. What are the switches that control the behavior and the genetics of the cell? And the answer is they're called perceptions. The cell perceives the world and uses these perceptions to activate the behavior and the genetics. So I say, well, how does a cell work? I show that signals come up to the membrane surface. The signal binds to these receptors. The effectors then, like a cascade, like one domino hitting another domino, send a signal through the cell. Every time a signal is passed from one protein to another, it causes the protein to move, and the movement is the metabolic activities that keep us alive, be it digestion or respiration, whatever. So the signal activate behavior. This is the newest main area of science, and it's called signal transduction. So moving away from genes, we're now studying signal transduction, the mechanism by which, how does an environmental signal get translated into a biological response? So we just showed one way where the environmental signal is passed to the proteins in the body. Now watch this. The signals from the cytoplasm can now go into the nucleus, and when they're in the nucleus, they affect the genetic material called the chromosomes. And I say, so that the signal not only comes from the environment and affects behavior, but the signal can then enter into the nucleus and activate the reading of genes. And this is a subdivision of signal transduction that is highly specialized. It's called epigenetic control. And you say, what does that mean? I say, well, what did I teach in school? Genetic control. And I say, what does that mean? Control by genes. I say, what is epigenetic control? And there's that little prefix. I want to just tell you how funny it is. This little EPI prefix changes the entire civilization that we live in. Because I'm going to tell you what the epi stands for. It means above. So when I say epigenetic control, then literally what I'm saying, control above the genes. The control is not in the genes. It never was in the genes. So the new science changes our belief system that we're not victims of the genes. We have to find out, so what's above the genes? Well, I said, well, first let's see how genes work. And I show you inside the cell, we open up the nucleus, and there you open it up, and the chromosomes pop out. And you get 23 chromosomes from your mother and 23 from your father, and these are hereditary units. I say, yeah, but what's a chromosome made out of? I say, it's made out of a core of DNA, so there's 50% DNA, and a sleeve of protein wrapping up the DNA, and that's 50% protein. And the question is, what does the protein do? Because for the last 60 years, we've been focusing on the DNA. The question is, what does the 50% of the chromosome protein do? Well, for 50 years, they threw it away. Because they weren't interested in it, because we already had the answers. Everything's DNA. And finally, we started to recognize there was something missing, and now we go back to that 50% protein we throw away, and now that's where the secret comes from of how genes are controlled. So we look at a chromosome, and it's a core of DNA with a sleeve of protein. So as a model, I'll just use my arm. And I'll say, if I pull my sleeve down, you see my bare arm. And if I took a magic marker and wrote the genetic code for blue eyes, all those A, T, C's, and G's of the genetic code, I write with a magic marker, I hold up my arm to the audience right now, and I say, can you read the gene for blue eyes, yes or no? And hopefully, I mean, if the letters were big enough, of course you could read the gene. I say, yeah, but what does it look like when it's back inside the nucleus? I go, oh, it looks like this. And I pull my sleeve back over my arm and I say, can you read the gene for blue eyes right now? And the answer is absolutely not. I say, well, if you want to read the gene for blue eyes, what do you got to do? Pull the sleeve back. Great. I love that because the answer is exactly that simple. But then I say, but what causes a protein to change shape so that it will come off of the DNA core? And the answer goes back to, what causes a protein to change shape? Oh, you forgot already. The environmental signals. So basically, if I showed you how it worked in a video, then what you see is a chromosome is inside the nucleus. A chromosome is a linear strand of DNA with genes, one after the other, connected in a long strand. At the beginning of each gene segment, there's specialized proteins called regulatory proteins. Great name. They regulate the genes. How do they do that? Because when the signal binds to the regulatory protein, the protein sleeve pops off, and now you expose the DNA. Now you can read the DNA. So the cell sends up a protein to copy the DNA, but makes a copy called RNA. The RNA version of that gene goes into the cytoplasm where I use it as a blueprint to make the protein. And when I have the RNA, I don't need the gene anymore. So the signal pops off the regulatory proteins and the sleeve covers up the DNA. Now, why is that important? Well, after 50 years of hearing that DNA has all this control over your life, you look at this animation, you go, okay, I ask, when does the DNA do something? I say, come on, do something, DNA. And the DNA is just a blueprint. It just stays there until the cell reads the blueprint. The blueprint does not determine what gets read. The cell determines what blueprints are being read. And the cell does that through the switches, which are called perceptions. So the simple bottom line is this. The perceptions of the cell select the genes that are being read. So we go back to our old story, which is the central dogma, which is in all the textbooks, and that's what students are still learning. Information goes from DNA to RNA to protein. And I go, well, not really correct. And I say, why? Well, you left some stuff out. I say, the first thing you left out is the regulatory proteins over the DNA sleeve. So before the DNA can be activated, the first thing you have to do is activate the regulatory protein. Like, yeah, and I go, yeah, but what regulates the proteins? And I go, the environmental signals. So basically, DNA is in the middle of a flow chart that starts with environmental signal, activates regulatory protein, which exposes the DNA, allows a copy of RNA to be made, and the blueprint RNA is used to make the protein of the body. It's not the primacy of DNA, as the textbooks talk about. It's the primacy of the environment. And this is exactly what the culture cells show. I take them from environment A, put them in environment B, they change their entire behavior. Now, here's a most interesting fact, which epigeneticists have now come to understand. The way you perceive the environment changes the way the genes are read. It doesn't change the gene, it changes the way they're read, meaning one gene blueprint can be read in, for example, 30,000 different variations based on what's going on in the environment. And why is that important? It's like, well, you're not locked into any gene, anything. You can make 30,000 variations of every gene in your body based on your environment and your perception of the environment. And more importantly, here's an interesting fact, and this is a given fact. I put cells in a petri dish, and in a great environment, they grow, they flourish, they're healthy, very lovely cells, everything's great. I take that dish, move it into a less than optimum environment. The cells will immediately start to get sick, they'll begin to die, the culture will crash, and if I had a conventional medically trained, pharmaceutically driven doctor would look at my sick cells in culture and they go, Bruce, your cells are sick. They need some drugs. And I would say, absolutely not. You do not put drugs in my cell culture because all you have to do is take the culture from the bad environment, put it right back in the good environment. The cells will immediately become healthy and recover without any drugs at all. The fate or state of the cells is a complement to the environment in which they find themselves. That's a given. Now, so I say change the culture medium, change the fate of the cells. Here's the interesting part. I go back to the story I told you earlier, and the story is this. You are not a one thing. You have 50 trillion cells inside of you. The honest truth is you are a skin-covered Petri dish. And you have 50 trillion cells in you, and you have culture medium, and you've seen the culture medium. If you cut yourself, the blood that runs out is the culture medium that nourishes the cells. And I go, well, that's really cool. Why? Because there's no difference in the function of the cell, whether it's in a plastic dish or a skin dish. It will respond to the culture environment. You change the composition of the culture medium, you change the fate of the cells. I say, well, how does this work? So I say, the human, like the cell, reads the environment, both the internal and external environment, what's going on in the world. I say, well, who reads it or what reads it? I say, the brain reads it because the brain is the perception mechanism. It doesn't interpret. It reads the signals. What interprets the signals, this is the interesting part, is the thing we call the mind. The mind, the brain brings in the signal. The mind makes an interpretation of the signal. In response to that interpretation, the mind causes the brain to release chemistry. That chemistry that is released by the brain is then carried by the nervous system to the blood and to the tissues and organs of the body. What's the important point? The important point is this, that the chemistry of the blood is controlled by the brain, and the brain releases the chemistry in response to the perception of the environment. As you change the environment or your perception of the environment, you change the genetic activity in your cells. As simple as that. And what's interesting, I say, so what's the function of this mind that does the interpretation? Well, here's the critical understanding. The mind holds beliefs. That's what it holds, beliefs, perceptions that have been programmed. And I said, well, what's neat about that? I said, because the function of the mind is to make reality out of the perceptions. If this is what you believe about life, then you create a life that matches your beliefs. And this makes sense, because what if your life, every day you got up and you held a whole bunch of beliefs about life, and every day all those beliefs were challenged because nothing worked out? And that we know, yeah, but I get up every day, I know what's going to happen. Why? And I say, because you're actually creating what's happening using your mind to run your biology to manifest what you have in the program. So basically, that's what the function is. And to make it simplified, when I talk about this, it's a simple statement. It just says the function of the mind, create coherence between your beliefs and reality. And yet what I want you to understand, that is the most fundamental awareness that you need to know, for a very simple reason. If you change your beliefs, you change your reality. And the answer is absolutely true. Every level of that is absolutely true. Okay? So I go, okay, well, how does this really work? And I go, well, listen, you know, we go to a paint shop. And there's this big display of all the paint chips with all the colors spanning the rainbow. And I go, that's really pretty. I say, how do you make these colors? I say, well, you start with white paint and you add a combination of tints to it. I say, well, what does that? I say, well, there's this machine that will translate these colors. And I say, in our analogy for my story, I say, what does the color chips represent? I said, they're like emotions. Some, you know, red is hot, blue is cold, green, envy, whatever. You know, you can put all these emotions to color. I say, yeah, but what creates the colors? And I say, in the paint shop is a paint mixer. And that paint mixer has all these different colored tints. And I say, so the you look on the back of the color chip, and it says, to make this color, take a little bit of this, and take a little of this tint, and a little of that tint, blend them together, and there you got the color. And I go, really cool. I say, so what in your body is the paint mixer? And the answer is, the paint mixer is your brain. And I said, well, how does it work? And I said, well, it doesn't release tints. What it releases are neurochemicals. The neurochemicals are together like recipes, and I can make any color emotion by mixing the right neurochemicals together in the right proportion, and these neurochemicals go into the blood and shape the character of your life. So basically, it says your mind is generating the emotions that will shape your behavior and your genetics. And so basically, this is how simple it works. I said, well, how does it work? I go, okay, I'm a cell biologist, but what's interesting is every one of us as individual humans is what I would call a self biologist, because you manage your own biology. And I say, well, how does it work? I say, imagine this. You sit here, and what you're recognizing is this. Your blood is coursing through your body. Your blood is nourishing all your cells. The composition of your blood, which is the culture medium, determines the fate and behavior of what's going on. So the chemistry from the brain is put into the blood, and the blood is the culture medium fed to the cells. that's cool at this point. And then I say, okay, now that you're sitting here, I say, if you close your eyes for a moment, I say, now visualize something you so love, like something, you know, someone or something that so generates love in your life. And I say, when you open your eyes and that's present in your world, your brain releases some very important chemicals into the mix. When you're in love, you release dopamine, which is the pleasure chemical. You release oxytocin, which is a bonding chemical. And you start to release serotonin, which is a chemical, when added to growth medium, enhances the growth of the cells. Growth hormone is also released. So these are the chemicals. If I add those chemicals, dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and growth hormone in my tissue culture dishes, those cells will flourish, grow, have tremendous amounts of energy, and be fully healthy. And I go, this is precisely why when you fall in love, you are so healthy. Because at that point, you're releasing the chemistry into your culture medium that supports full-out growth and harmony in your biology. And that's why we're driven to be in love. It's a biological thing that brings health to us. I say, okay, same people sitting here with the same brain and the same chemistry. And I say, no, this time you close your eyes and then I think of something. I say, think of something that scares you. And I say, now when you open your eyes, if you see that thing in front of you, guess what? Hey, you're not releasing dopamine and oxytocin anymore. Now you're going to release cortisol, stress hormones, inflammatory agents, things that actually shut down your growth system. They shut down your immune system. And they do that not because they want to punish you, but when you're in stress and in fear, you want to conserve all of your energy to run away from the threat. So the design of the system is the moment you get in stress, you cut off all energy expenditures except those necessary to escape the threat. Of course, the interesting part through the evolution of humanity is that we were only supposed to use it every now and then if a lion chased you. You can get the hell out of there. That would be really great. But the interesting part was once the lion was gone, you would go back into the growth mode again because stress puts you in a protection mode. And I say, well, the protection mode shuts off all the growth mechanisms. I go, yes, and shuts down your immune system. That's why when you're in stress, you start to get sick very quickly at this point. So the whole issue about this understanding is simply this. As you change the way you look at the world, you dynamically change the chemistry that comes from your brain to match what your perceptions are. And if we are stressed like that, and this is what's the problem in our world today, is I said in the ancient world, you were stressed just for that moment of getting away from that lion. But once the lion was gone, you returned right back to full growth again. Our world is 24/7, 365 stress. What chemistry do we release when you watch the news and read the newspapers and hear about all the financial stuff, the oil stuff, and all these problems? You're releasing stress hormones into your body, which are preparing you to save your life in the threats that you perceive. Well, immediately the time you do that, you are also shutting down the growth of your system and you're shutting off your immune system. And that's why people who are under stress are responsible for 90% of doctor visits in the United States. 90% of health issues in the United States are all due to prolonged stress, which shuts down the system. So I say, okay, cool. Where do you get the beliefs from? This is a critical part. Where do you get the beliefs from that your mind is doing the interpretations of the world around you? Well, I say, well, you get the from your mind, but there are two parts to the mind. There's the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. And they're very different from each other. The conscious mind is actually just the latest evolution of the brain right behind your forehead called the prefrontal cortex. The rest of the entire brain was there before consciousness, so that by definition would constitute the subconscious mind. And it's very big compared to the conscious mind, but they have very profoundly different functions. And here's what they are. And this is very critical to recognize this very important point. The two minds are not necessarily connected to each other to this extent. And this is where we have a failure. Our general failure comes from the fact that if I give awareness and information to my conscious mind, it will automatically change the programs in the subconscious mind. It's like, no, this has not happened. And so why is this important? It's because they don't learn in the same way. And this is why our consciousness is much more intelligent than the lives that we lead. And I'll give a reason for this. And it goes like this. Conscious mind, prefrontal cortex, subconscious mind, essentially the rest of the brain. I say, what's the functional difference? And now this is the cool part. The evolutionary form in the front of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, which has consciousness, represents your identity, your source, your spirit. Who are you as an individual different than any other person on this planet? This is your personal identity. And what's very important about the conscious mind, it is not time-bound. The conscious mind can think into the future. The conscious mind can go into the past. The conscious mind can disconnect from the moment, go up in your head or out of your head and solve problems somewhere. What's the point? The conscious mind does not have to pay attention to what's going on because it can time travel. But it's also the conscious mind is the sources of your wishes and your desires and your aspirations. These are creativity. I say, what do you want from your life? Well, you don't have it. And the conscious mind can give you an image, so the conscious mind's creating from that. So the conscious mind is primarily creative, has your wishes, your desires, and your aspirations. It's also the source of positive thinking. And before people go, oh, not that stuff again, I can explain. Positive thinking is very effective if you know how to use it, and if you don't know how to use it, it's totally useless. So there's an understanding you must have to employ positive thinking. And I go, well, this is really cool. This is what the conscious mind is about. And I say, what about the subconscious? Well, here's an important part. Subconscious mind is time-bound. It's always in the present moment. It's always in the present moment. The subconscious does not go back into history and review the past. It doesn't go into the future and create anything. It is always in the present moment, which means if you learned something 40 years ago, and I ask your subconscious, when did you learn that? They say, right now. And basically, why is this point? Because there's no time in the subconscious. It's a device. And it's primarily habitual. It's primarily habitual because it's where we learn things. And before people condemn it, because there's always a tendency to condemn the subconscious mind for all the problems, I'm going to tell you it's a machine. It's basically a record playback device. That's what its function is. And so if you say, is this tape recorder a good tape recorder or a bad tape recorder? And the point is, you can't say good or bad about the tape recorder. How about the programming? Oh, well, the programming could be good or bad, but not the tape recorder. So let's take the weight off the subconscious as being the bad guy. It's the tape recorder, okay? And I say, what's its function? Well, it has your instincts built into it, the experiences that you acquired over life that you memorized, repeated, habituated, and can do now without thinking. For example, when you're an infant, you didn't know how to walk. You had to learn how to walk. And there was a period, if you could go back in your infant mind, you were struggling how to keep this balance, and you were learning. But guess what? You learned that how many years ago, when you were 3, 2, whatever that was, something back there. And I say, yeah, but guess what? Once you learned it, you never had to go back and relearn it again. So the subconscious mind is really cool. It allows me to walk every day without having to relearn it again. And I say, driving a car. You didn't know how to drive a car before you got your permit. There was no data in the subconscious mind to drive a car, but guess what? You learned with your conscious mind, put the program in by habituating it, driving and driving and driving, just like walking and walking until you get it right. Now guess what? Now you've been driving for years, and here's the point. You can get in the car, have a conversation with a passenger, drive for 10 or 15 minutes, look out the window, and then realize you haven't paid attention to the road for the last 15 minutes. I go, okay, who was driving the car? And the answer was this, well, not your conscious mind. Your conscious mind was busy. I say, yeah, well, what was your conscious mind doing? It was in conversation. So I say, can you then tell me about your conversation for the last 15 minutes? You go, yeah, I can tell you we talked about this and this and this. And I go, okay, but you've been driving for 10 or 15 minutes. Can you tell me what was going on the road for the last 10 or 15 minutes? The answer is absolutely not. I didn't see it. This is the most fundamental understanding. If I come across with any message today, it is this. Your subconscious, by definition, plays habits without you seeing it. It does not need to be overseen by the conscious mind. It doesn't need your observations or your permission. The subconscious mind will engage in pre-programmed learned behaviors and do this without you even paying attention. Not only does the subconscious mind learn from these life experiences where you have personal experiences, but you can learn indirectly through teaching. Other people can teach your subconscious mind so that when you go to school and you start to do a lot of repetition, you're basically taking other people's belief systems and then repeating them and creating habits out of them in your subconscious mind. So it's really becomes important to understand this. The conscious mind is you, creative, your source, your spirit, whatever it is. It has all your wishes and desires in it. And in contrast, the subconscious mind is your friend, potentially, based on whether your programs are good or bad. And then all of a sudden you say, so where the heck did the programs come from? And here's what's really important. The first programs in the subconscious mind and the conscious mind come before you're born. And just before I leave this slide, I just want to bring up the fact that the two minds are not equally powerful. I mean, just physically, you can see that the conscious mind is just a little piece on the front of the brain, and the massive rest of the brain is a subconscious. So in recent studies, they did an analysis and found that the conscious mind, the small one, can process about 40 nerve impulses per second, meaning 40 nerve impulses come from the environment every second, and the conscious mind can sort them out, handle them, and respond to them all appropriately. And that sounds like that's pretty cool. And then I say, yeah, but the subconscious mind can process 40 million nerve impulses in the same very same second and handle them quite effectively, while your conscious mind couldn't even get near that. The subconscious mind is a million times more powerful. So we start with that fact. We're coming back to that, okay? The subconscious a million times more powerful than the conscious. Now I say, where do we learn our behavior? And I say, well, look, you're a fetus. I say, what's a fetus? A skin-covered petri dish. And I go, yeah, but where's the culture medium come from? In this case, it comes from the mother. I say, well, how do you feed the fetus? And the answer is, the blood of the mother passes by the placenta. The nutrition from the blood crosses the placenta, enters in, feeds the fetus, and the waste products from the fetus are transported out of the placenta, picked up by the mother's blood, and her system handles that, and that's really cool. And I say, well, what's really cool? I say, well, 40 years ago when I was teaching this, we say, well, what was the role of a mother? And we say, well, she's the one that nourishes the child. And I said, what about the development of the child? Oh, genes control the development of the child. So then what's the role of the mother? Oh, eat well, take vitamins and supplements and exercise. And that was probably the main directive that we could give, because we would say all the other traits and characteristics are controlled by the genes. So just nourish the child the best you can. And then I ask a very important question. Is nutrition the only thing in blood? The answer is, of course not. It's got all the emotional chemicals, all the hormones, all the regulatory factors, the growth factors, everything's in the blood. So what's the point? The point is this, that the fetus, all that's growing in the womb, is actually being nourished by the mother's blood and all the information in the mother's blood. And the significant about that is then the fetus's environment is the mother's environment. And you say, well, why is that important? And the answer is very simple. And the answer is this, the mother is nature's head start program. She sees the world, and how she responds to the world and adjusts her emotions and her behaviors and her regulates her metabolic activity and her genetic activity. She's sending that information and adjusting her fetus's genetic activity. So here's an important point. The mother, and I can't put the mother in this alone for sure, because the father is a duo partner, the other partner. Why? The father screws up and messes up the mother's life, which then messes up the fetus's life. So it's the mother and father are actually controlling the genetics and behavior of the child. So that parents are genetic engineers. They shape the genetics of their child based on their perception's response to the world. And you go, why would nature do that? And nature is intelligent for this reason. Nature knows the environment's always changing. How can I tell you what best genetics you should use 20 years from now when you're going to have a child? I can't tell you that. So nature says, guess what? I'll wait till the conception. And after the conception, I'll read the environment via the mother and adjust the genetics of the child so when it's born and fits the environment of the mother, it will adapt perfectly as the mother has into the same environment. So the mother is nature's head start program, more or less, in this regard. And I go, that's really cool. And I say, well, here's a problem. And here's the problem, because what I'm going to show you is a sonogram. It's an experiment that was set up. It's in Italy. It's in Italian. And you don't have to understand the dialogue, because it's an argument that was between the mother and the father while using a sonogram to see the response of the fetus. And so an argument, whether it's in Italian or any language, still sounds the same. So I don't care about the language. Just watch. And what you'll notice is this. As the process is going, when the parents get in the argument, watch the fetus. The fetus jumps, arches back in shock, a total response of shock to the environment. Every time these shocks that the mother is experiencing, because when her emotional chemicals are in shock, the fetus is in shock. And so the result is every time this kind of shock comes into the system, it's being recorded by the fetus. And why is that relevant? Because what we're beginning to find out now is, by the time a child is born, it has learned the behavior patterns of the mother, and so 50% of the child's behavior is essentially established at the moment it's born, from the repeat patterns being repeated over the time period, not individual events that knock the fetus out of a balance, it's repetitive patterns that do it, and when there are repetitive patterns, the fetus will learn the repetitive patterns, so by the time it's born, it's already got the behavioral emotional patterns built in. But it's interesting, because these patterns of behavior are like a song, meaning there's lyrics and music. What the fetus learns is the musical score, but doesn't have the lyrics for, because it's not born interacting with the world. So when a child's born, it takes a musical score that it comes with and then will manifest the lyrics through its life experiences to match the song. So basically, Sue Gerhardt says in Why Love Matters, a great book on neural development in children, great book, 50% of our behavior or personality is determined by the time we're born through the experiences of the 9 months in the womb of learning. Okay? And then I go, well, what happens after you're born? I say, well, this is when you have to learn to fit into the world. And nature, again, set up a situation to support us to learn how to live in the world. And it basically says this. The brain does not develop equally. The brain develops with the sensory inputs before the motor outputs. In other words, a child can respond to the environment by knowing what's going on, but has no ability to make actually a response back out. It can feel the stimulus, but it can't do the response because the output, the motor coordination, doesn't work. And that's why children get very frustrated, because in their minds they know exactly what they want to say or do, and yet none of the machinery is working because it works later. When we look at the brain activity during this developmental period, we find that unlike a human, which has all levels of EEG frequencies, which is from the lowest delta, the next one up is theta, next higher frequency is alpha, which is calm consciousness, the next higher one is beta, which is focused schoolroom consciousness, and there's even a higher frequency called gamma, which is peak performance. And so there are these levels of frequencies, and what they show, a child does not have all levels of frequency working when it's born. It ramps up over time. So for the first 2 years of a child's life, it's in the lowest frequency delta, which for adults are unconscious. But for a child, it's basically, remember, the child's like behind a plate glass window. It's observing the world but can't interact with it. So that's a delta for a child. It's not participating in the world. From 2 until 6, the EEG of a child ramps up to the next higher level, so it's predominantly in theta. Theta is a state of imagination. That's why children mix the imaginary world and the real world together. And in doing that, the children are sharing a theta activity in real life. But theta, and I'm going to tell you right now, the most important point is a hypnagogic trance. Theta is hypnosis. And then I say, well, after the child is 6, it begins to start expressing alpha activity, which is calm consciousness as a predominant brain state. And by the time it's 12, it ramps up to the full beta state, which is focused schoolroom consciousness. And I go, well, what's important? And the first thing you can look at, if you see the chart, a child does not have consciousness activity in the brain, EEG activity representing consciousness, until after it's 6. The first 6 years of its child's life is predominantly in a hypnosis state, the low brain frequency. Yes, this is where children get programmed. Nature designed this. Again, nature couldn't say what culture was going to be needed in any time in the future. So nature says, look, program the child first 6 years. This is where the brain is in a hypnotic state. What does it do? It observes everything the parents do. All day long. Records it like a video camera. And what does it know? It knows how the parents respond to stress, how they respond to life, how they relate to each other, how they relate to the community, the family, to the police. Everybody, there's all different kinds of relationships, and a child downloads all this in the first 6 years because it's not conscious, it's below consciousness level. And it's really helpful because, I mean, if you really have a child to start to question everything you're trying to teach them, you can see how frustrating that would be. Why should I do that? And it's like you've had to do that 1,000 times a day, which at some age that actually cuts in a bit. It's very frustrating. So nature made it simple. It's just that just keep the child in hypnagogic trance, learn all the behavior from the parents. And why is that relevant? The answer is because this is where we get enculturated. This is where we learn how to be a part of our civilization, and we get downloaded from our parents responding to civilization. Okay? And this is also the most important part for where we go wrong in our own personal lives, and this is where we get self-identity during the first 6 years. And I say, what do you mean by that? And I say, this is where parents tell the child what the child is or who that child is. You're an adorable, loving human being. Or, who do you think you are? You're not smart enough. You don't deserve this. You're not lovable. You could do better than that. All these kinds of things. You're a sickly child. Whatever these pronouncements are, parents don't recognize if they say that to a child before the age of 6, they straight go down into the subconscious and become part of the subconscious program. Okay? So that's where basic fundamental subconscious programs come from. They don't come from you. They come from other people telling us about who we are. Now, parents don't mean to be irritating like that. Parents like the concept of, well, if you goad the child and, you know, stick a pin in it, it'll jump and it'll do something better. So if you're not good enough, what am I trying? Oh, then maybe you'll try and be good enough. Well, cool. If the child was conscious, that would make sense. If the child is just recording, then what has the child done? I am not good enough. It didn't say consciously how I could be better. It's just, I am not good enough. So the relevance about all this comes down to a simple fact that we get programmed in the first 6 years of our life. This is not new. The Jesuits have been saying this for 1,000 years. They would say, give me a child until it's 6 or 7 and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. Or give me a child and I will show you the man. What they knew for 1,000 years, if I can program your first 6 years, I control the rest of your life. You say, well, how does that happen? Well, the first thing is this. Recent science about understanding the nature of disease tell us this, that the propensity to get diseases in adulthood, which include diabetes, Alzheimer's, cancer, all these other particular diseases, anything you can list, the propensity to the disease is determined during the periconceptual, the fetal, and infant phases of life. Medicine is now fully recognized as the diseases we get as adults were founded in the programming in the pre to infant life period. And this is where we then manifest who we are and we create the chemistry of our lives. And then the function of our lives after that is to make the belief system manifest by releasing the chemistry which controls the fate of the cells. And now here comes the critical part, and this critical part is what we begin to find out is not only do these programs come in at this time and control our health, but here comes the part that is most effective to all of us, and that is just recent neuroscience. Neuroscience has now recognized that, and this is critical, that we are only cognizant or using our conscious mind 5% of the day. And that we operate 95% of the day from the subconscious mind. And you say, well, why is that relevant? I go, go back and look at the two different minds. The conscious mind has your wishes and desires and your aspirations, what you want from life. And I'd say 5% of the day, you're moving in that direction. 95% of the day, though, you are moving in the direction of the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind has other people's programs in it. And that's where the conflicts in our life come from. Because we're thinking I'm moving toward health or harmony in relationships or a great job. That's what I have great wishes for. And then we find out, my God, I'm only going that way 5% of the day. 95% I'm operating from not good enough. Who do you think you are? You're not lovable. And all of a sudden, it's, oh my God, these are the programs from other people. So the most interesting thing is that we're living lives right now where we have our great wishes and desires, our positive thinking. And I go, okay, do the math. And the math is this. You operate 95% of the day from the subconscious, which is 1 million times more powerful than the conscious mind. How much of a chance does that conscious mind have to override the programs? The answer is not very much. And this is where the problems come from. And then I say, yeah, but the real problems come from what I told you before. When it's subconscious, you don't see it. So you go back in your history, you have a friend you're very close with, you know your friend's behavior very, very well, and you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day you really start to recognize your friend has the same behavior as their parent. So it's a great day, you casually volunteer to your friend, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill. Because Bill's the first guy to go ballistic and say, how can you compare me to my dad? And I want to tell you the two most profound points of that story, and they're profound. And this is what it is. Number one, everybody else can see that Bill's behavior is like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. And profound point number two, we are all Bill. That means every one of us is playing behaviors that we do not see, that these fundamental behaviors come from the subconscious. Psychologists tell us about 70% of those programs are negative and redundant, and that basically we're not even living the lives we want. We struggle. And I say, well, then how do you know what's in your subconscious? You got it before you were 6. And here comes the fun part. You don't have to go backwards. For the simple reason is this. Your life is 5% from your conscious mind, 95% from your subconscious mind. What does that mean? That means your life is 95% a printout of the programs in your subconscious mind. So you don't have to go backwards to see what your issues are. You're facing them right now. And look at it very simply. It works like this. The things that work for you because those beliefs are already built into the subconscious. The things you struggle with, the things you find hard in life, the things you have to work at in life. Why are you struggling and working so hard? The answer is because you have programs in your subconscious mind that do not support those destinations. And so basically it says, do I have to go back and find out who said what to who? It's like, no, that's a waste of time. Matter of fact, it makes things worse for many people because they have to relive the same trauma over and over again, which caused it in the first place. The reality is you don't even have to go backwards. You have to say, what is it you want now? And this becomes really critical for us because this is where we have to understand the nature of who we are. We're not our conscious minds. We're really our subconscious minds. And I say, yeah, but what is the subconscious mind? I say, well, basically, you don't have to worry about that. It is your life. So look at your life. And I go, okay, cool. What do you do about it? I say, you can reprogram the subconscious mind. And if I didn't, this would be a real lousy program right here because I'd leave and go, oh, that's your life. I'm sorry. But the reality is you can reprogram it. And I say, well, how do you reprogram it? And this is very critical. Number one, there's nobody in the subconscious mind. And why is that relevant? Because how many of us talk to ourselves? And I say, well, who are you talking to? Well, I'm going to change that subconscious mind. I go, that's really great. You're going to get blue in the face. Why? I say, here's a tape recorder, old-fashioned tape recorder with a tape. And it's playing a program. And you say, you don't like this program. I say, good. Talk to the tape recorder for a while. Tell me how long you have to talk with it before the tape recorder is going to give you another program. And he answers, it's never going to do it that way. I go, precisely why we get frustrated. And I say, well, then I'll learn with my conscious mind. I go, you're going to read the self-help book. Yeah. I say, okay, you read the self-help book. I give you a test. I'm sure you're going to get 100. Did your life change? And the answer is no. But I'm really smart, but I don't understand. Still the same old life. I go to psychoanalysis. If you want to go back and review your life, you can go back and say, oh, my God, I know why my life sucks. I went through everything that went wrong. And I say, well, great, now you know why it's so bad. Did it change? The answer is, no, it sucks, but I know why it sucks. So it's much better. And the simple problem is this. Well, how do you change it? And the answer is, so how does it learn? And I go, well, number one, it learns by hypnosis. That's how you got the first 6 years down in your system in the first place. You were operating in theta. So if you got back into hypnosis, you could use that hypnosis to rewrite the subconscious program. Okay? And I go, cool, that's number one. And I say you could use things like subliminal tapes, anything that passes when you're in theta, which is just before you go to sleep because your brain frequencies slow down from the conscious level into delta, the unconscious level, and pass through theta. So that means every day when you're going to sleep or when you're waking up, your brain is operating in a theta period. And if you could download a program then you're just downloading it subconsciously. Many ways to do this, hypnosis and forms like that. Super learning techniques. This is relatively new. They're listed and grouped as things called energy psychology. And what's really interesting, a whole variety of different modalities, but there's one thing that's common about them. You can rewrite limiting beliefs that affected you, I don't care how many years old you are, you can generally rewrite beliefs in periods of 15, 20 minutes and change the whole thing. It's a new way of learning. It's super learning. It really generally involves bringing consciousness to control the system. There are many aspects to it, like bringing right and left brains into harmony because they're not in harmony once we start past childhood. But to learn and super learning, bring them into harmony. Okay. That's one way. And then I go the last way. And I go, the last way is habit. That's how we learned everything in the first place. But habit, it takes a period of time. And you got to do it religiously. You're going to do it. You can't just say, well, I'll do it Monday and maybe next week I'll try it again. Or I'll put a sticky note on the refrigerator. And if I walk by, maybe I'll read that sticky note. And I'm going, that's not a habit. Okay, that's a wish, more or less, at that point. Habits are repetitive processes. I say, well, what is the most effective way? And this is really cool because ancient history told us, and one of the most effective ways is what people have told us for a couple thousand years, and that is be mindful. I say, what does being mindful mean? I say, being mindful means you keep in your present mind, with your conscious mind, you keep right here at the moment. You don't let it wander. You don't let it go to the future. You don't let it go to the past. You don't let it disconnect from what you're working on. Why? Because if you're in your conscious moment, that's your moment of power. And if you can make your conscious moments all day long, then you're living in power all day long because you're making all your decisions based on your wishes and desires and not letting the habit make it. I say, what is the consequence of this mindfulness? And then I go back and I say, you've all done it at one time in your life, especially after you were a teenager. So let me explain to you what happened when you did it. And it's called the honeymoon effect. I say, well, what is the honeymoon effect? I said, go back to a time in your life when you fell head over heels in love. And I ask you if you can get back and you can visualize that time period. I say, if you can get back there, were you healthy when you were in love? And the answer is, my God, you were never healthy in your entire life when you were in love like that. I say, did you have energy? Oh, we had so much energy. We made love for days. Nobody stopped for food. It was great. We had a lot of good times. I say, was life so beautiful that every day you woke up in that honeymoon state and said, my God, it's heaven on earth. I'm living heaven on earth. And people go, yeah. And I go, okay, guess what? That health, that energy, that vision of harmony in heaven on earth was an actual creation. It wasn't an accident. You manifested it. And if you knew how to do it and you knew how to keep it, then there's no reason why a honeymoon has to fade out. You can live your entire life in a honeymoon state. And it's a honeymoon state, which is we're all driven to try to find in this world. That's why people are always looking for this relationship to get me to that honeymoon state. Why? Because in that state, you release all those chemicals of health. You release all those chemicals that keep you vibrant, that give you energy, that maintain your body, that give your immune system power pack energy to keep you as that healthy and vibrant person. And it's interesting because a recent publication on mindfulness, they were studying where people's minds were. And I just love it because the quote out of this paper, a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. That's the title of the paper. And what it means is, why is it a wandering mind unhappy? And the answer is this. Because when your conscious mind's wandering, then you're running off the subconscious programs, which are other people's programs. That's not a happy situation. And here's the little quote. Mind wandering occurred in 46.9% of the samples, and at least 30% of the samples taken during every activity except making love. And why is that? Because the point is this. When you're making love, you don't want your mind to wander. And the relevance of being in love is that you keep your mind in the present moment. And when you keep your mind in the present moment, then you live in the honeymoon state. And you say, well, why does the honeymoon end? And the answer is simple. Life gets so busy at some point that your mindfulness wanders. Your conscious mind's now thinking about paying the rent, fixing the car, whatever it is. Your loving partner who is knowing you in this conscious state of, you know, of honeymoon comes up to you, asks you a wonderful, simple question. You turn around and just jam on her, blah, 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 blah. And the fact was this, who just made the response? And the answer was, it wasn't you, it was perhaps the way your father or your mother made the response, and you were playing out their behavior. Now here's why the honeymoon ends, is because now you just did that, and your partner looks at you totally confused, where did that personality just come from? And then they say to you, what kind of behavior is that? And now go back. It was subconscious behavior. Did you see it? Absolutely not. So then you're now being accused of something, and you go, very defensively, what are you talking about? And all of a sudden you find this is where the honeymoon starts to wander and disappear at some point. And it disappears for a very simple reason. The idea is this. The honeymoon works when two conscious minds that have wishes, desires, and aspirations get together and create the life of those wishes. And I say when the honeymoon ends, when two uninvited minds come in, the subconscious minds, because they bring in programs that were never part of the honeymoon. And all of a sudden then it's the, okay, how do I adapt to this situation or do I adapt? And that's where we all run into problems. And yet the reality is this. Think about a very simple point, and it goes like this, is that if you would reprogram your subconscious mind with your wishes and your desires and aspirations, that means when you're not paying attention, you'd still be doing everything you were doing on that honeymoon, which means a honeymoon could be for the rest of your life. And when you do that, you will bring health and harmony to you and everyone around you because you'll radiate that energy. And love is what lightens up this entire world, and that's what we need to find right now as we're beginning to face an interesting reality. The second book that I wrote, Spontaneous Evolution, is actually an extension of this because it basically says, the biology belief says, how your personal life is controlled by your own thoughts and so your perceptions control your life. I say, but what if millions of people share the same perceptions? And all of a sudden you realize that's when we manifest life. And the issue about that, why it's important, is that we are living in perceptions that are not sustainable. And we have to get these new beliefs in, and specifically who we are as powerful entities, that we're not victims of all this. We can eliminate that whole medical corporate entity by recognizing the power of health is in our own minds, and it was caused by our minds not supporting who we are. You don't need the drugs. You really got to come back. That doesn't mean there's a lot of people that actually will use medical support, people that have birth defects, that have an issue with their proteins that change their structure or their behavior. And I say, well, what's interesting, it's less than 5% of the population. 95% of us got here with a perfectly wonderful set of genes to have the most wonderful, happy life experience on this planet. That you change the genetic activity as you change your perceptions, and that all of a sudden takes you out of the class of being a victim of your genetics and puts you in the total seat of master. You can change your beliefs, you can change your perceptions, you can change your environment, and every one of those things will impact your behavior and your genetics. You're very powerful people. And so if you're really interested to see what's happening, because we're coming to an evolutionary crisis within the year or two, it's going to be an upheaval here, and it's all based on the world, as I started out, is not sustainable. New beliefs are now coming in. And when the population owns the new beliefs, such as this control of epigenetics and behavior by your mind, when people stop being victims and start being empowered, the world will change. Because if you just ask the mass of the population, what do they really want in this world? I would imagine 90% of the people give you the exact same answer. They want some food, they want a job, they want a place to live, they want protection. And if 90% of us just want the simple harmony of this life, then you ask the question, why don't we have it in this world? And the answer is because 90% of us are disempowered. And they've been disempowered ever since the beginning by people who knew from over 1,000 years ago that if I can get your first 6 years, I own you. And now it's time to take back your life. You are more powerful than anybody could ever imagine. You can walk across hot coals. You can lift up a car, as women do, if there's a child trapped under. I lift up a car. A weightlifter can't even do that. I love it, as I talk about in my lecture, people down in the South work themselves up in a religious ecstasy of a belief that God protects them, and they drink strychnine, and they have no adverse effects. Now, imagine that. If you could drink poison and not have any adverse effects, and what's your concern about eating some sugar and a Twinkie, okay? Think about it. And I'm done. And I am done. And I so appreciate your patience. So I used up my hour. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
I am Adria Breyer, a member of the Health and Medicine Forum at the Commonwealth Club. I had not the heart to interrupt Bruce because it took us over a year and a half to get him here. You can go, and we are very grateful, as you can see. You can go onto his website and sign up for his email list to know when we might be fortunate enough to have him locally. He has CDs, he has books, and I'm hoping he has online commentary like you're just giving us. So go onto his website. Let's see. The website is
BruceLipton.com.
We'll have a little surprise when I'm done moderating here. Our thanks to Bruce Lipton. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. It will be available on the Commonwealth Club website in the not-too-distant future. The meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.